This is Heathrow Airport, one of the great transport hubs of the nation, indeed, of the world. These terminals are thronged with many thousands of businessmen here to carry on the trade that is the country's lifeblood. And through these freight hangars pass many millions of pounds worth of manufactured goods on their way to every corner of the globe. The air transport industry has transformed the economic geography of the world, and it's all happened within the space of a man's lifetime. It's only 70-odd years since somewhat unreliable biplanes took off here from Hounslow Heath, hoping to make it to Paris. And the entire British aerospace industry is only a few years older than that. In that time, it's grown from the most fragile beginnings to its present huge scale. Second only in terms of size to the aerospace industry of the United States, second to none in terms of range and capability. Now, the history of its growth and development over the years is a story of the most remarkable success and achievement. And this program sets out to chart some of that history.
In the beginning, flying was the exclusive province of the true pioneers, men who had both a passion for aircraft, the vision and energy to found an industry. The Wright brothers, of course, Roe, Blériot, Voisin, Sopwith and many others. And then, as it became possible to buy an aeroplane, the brave and the rich were attracted too, for flying had become the ultimate adventure. But it wasn't long before the aeroplane attracted the attention of the military. Following trials at Lark Hill in 1912, the Royal Flying Corps was founded. Although cavalry officers were frowned upon if they elected to join the new and subordinate service, the general view was that aeroplanes would never amount to anything because they would frighten the horses. The UK went to war in 1914 with a fledgling air force numbering fewer than 200 aircraft, mainly Farman Longhorns and Blériots. But it was a war essentially of foot soldiers and horses and mud. The role of the RFC was marginal. It was a better way of seeing over the hill. Pilots and observers engaged enemy scouts with sidearms and rifles, occasionally dropped hand grenades and bricks and bombs on enemy trenches. In 1915, however, Roland Garros, a French ace, fitted deflector plates to his propeller. That enabled him to use the aircraft to aim a machine gun. Within a matter of weeks, a brilliant Dutch engineer, Anton Fokker, designed a rather more elegant solution, a reliable interrupter gear that allowed the gun to fire only when the propeller was clear. The German Fokker Eindecker, armed with this device, cut a swathe through the Allied air forces that became known as the Fokker Scourge. But the arms race was on. The endless demand for more firepower, higher speeds, better rates of climb, better technology. It's a race that has never come to an end. On the 28th of March 1916, the Society of British Aircraft Constructors was formed. And by the end of the year, most of the familiar names had become members. A.B. Rowe, Blackburn, Bolton Paul, Bristol, Handley Page, Vickers and Westland. And in the forcing house of war, the industry grew with immense speed. Slow and lumbering pusher biplanes were replaced by highly manoeuvrable and highly potent flying machines. The redoubtable Sopwith Camel became a legend on the Western Front. It had a top speed of 115 miles an hour, and with twin Vickers machine guns, it became a superb hunter-killer, claiming more enemy victims than any other type. The SE-5A from RAE Farnborough was very much less demanding to fly than the Camel, an important factor when pilots were being sent to the front with only 15 or 16 hours' experience, and it proved to be a very stable gun platform. With its 200 horsepower Hispano-Suiza engine giving a top speed of almost 140 miles an hour and a ceiling of over 19,000 feet. That, remember, in open cockpits without oxygen or indeed without a parachute. And some of the greatest British aces, such as Mick Mannock and Albert Ball, achieved their fame in SE-5As. Meanwhile, in response to the increasing frequency of German air raids in 1917 and 18, a heavy bomber force was created. Its standard aircraft was the giant Handley Page 0400, nicknamed the Bloody Paralyzer. It was over 60 feet long and had a 100-foot wingspan. And it was powered by two Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, developing 360 horsepower each. A Over 400 of these monsters were built. And flown by just a two-man crew, they could carry 2,000 pounds of bombs at around 100 miles an hour, and they could stay airborne, and often did, for up to 10 hours. By 1918, the aircraft industry had adopted the mass production techniques developing in the car industry. In the closing months of the war, SBAC companies were turning out 2,700 aircraft a month. And at the end of the war, in November 1918, the RAF, which had been formed on the 1st of April of that year from the RFC and the Royal Naval Air Service, had over 22,000 aircraft of various types. Over 33,000 aircraft had been destroyed in action or scrapped. And this country had a thriving aero industry which had scarcely existed before. Hundreds of factories had been built or converted for the sole purpose of building aircraft or aircraft components. But it suddenly became an industry without a customer. The RAF was virtually dismantled. In the space of a few months, it was reduced from 188 squadrons to a mere 12. And the government made it clear they had no interest in placing new aircraft orders. The public, too, were sick of war and wished to enjoy that peace that the war to end all wars had promised. Flying once again became a great adventure at weekend shows in ex-military aircraft sold at giveaway prices. But while the RAF reconciled itself to making do with its ageing wartime designs well into the 1920s, like these Bristol fighters seen here in frontline service in Mesopotamia, the aircraft industry had to find new outlets. In June 1919, Alcock and Brown, two RAF pilots, flew a surplus Vickers Vimy bomber across the Atlantic to claim the prize of £10,000 offered by the Daily Mail. This epic flight underlined for all to see the immense progress in both airframes and engines achieved during the war, particularly the reliability of the liquid-cooled inline engines. The two Rolls-Royce Eagles safely carried the Vimy through gales and storms across the vast space of the threatening Atlantic. The record-breaking flight ended in an Irish bog. Alcock and Brown returned to a hero's welcome. It would be 30-odd years before commercial aircraft would make the Atlantic crossing a matter of routine. But the seed of a whole new industry had been sown, air transport. On August the 25th, 1919, Air Transport and Travel, owned by the Aircraft Manufacturing Company, started daily flights from Hounslow to Le Bourget in Paris, using converted DH-4s or DH-16-like bombers, carrying two or four passengers in the little compartment behind the pilot. Flight time was just over 2 hours. In September of the same year, Handley Page Transport started services with a number of Handley Page twin-engine types from Cricklewood to Brussels. But all the pioneer airlines suffered severe financial difficulties. In April 1924, the struggling companies were merged into a single national carrier, the proud Imperial Airways. To help build the Imperial network, in 1925, Alan Cobham flew a DH-50 on an epic route survey from England, south to the Cape and on to Australia, a round trip of some 28,000 miles. From 1926, the big three-engined Armstrong Whitworth Argosy, in all its spindly elegance, carried the Imperial Airways flag into Europe, Paris to Bâle, Brussels and Cologne. Despite the open cockpit for the pilots, the accommodation for the 20 passengers was more spacious and luxurious than had ever previously been offered. And these safe and reliable aircraft, renowned for always being on schedule, remained in service for over 10 years. In 1929, the Wall Street crash occurred, sent its tremors reverberating around the world. Order books dwindled away and factories were closed down all over the country. But in 1931, despite the slump, Britain showed the quality of its aviation technology by winning the Schneider Trophy outright. The aircraft was the supremely beautiful S6B designed by R.J. Mitchell and powered by Rolls-Royce. The significance of this combination of talents was to extend far beyond the winning of the trophy itself. And a few days later, the second S6B, its engine boosted to 2,600 horsepower, put the icing on the cake by raising the world speed record to a then staggering 407 miles an hour. And in 1933, two Western single-engine biplanes carried the flags to new heights when they flew over Mount Everest. Meanwhile, Handley Page had rolled out the ultimate airliner of the 30s, the giant HP-42. 90 feet long, with its 130-foot wingspan, this huge biplane was designed specifically to carry passengers, not particularly rapidly, but in great style and safety, to the furthest reaches of the empire. It's powered by four 550-horsepower air-cooled Bristol Jupiter engines, mounted near the centre line to simplify asymmetric handling. Props couldn't be feathered in those days. It carried either 24 or 38 passengers, depending on the internal layout. The HP-42 was really a transitional design. With the hopes of all metal construction and mostly metal clad, the flying surfaces and the rear fuselage were still fabric covered, and the tail was a biplane design. But operating out of Croydon, then London's international airport, these flagships of the line made their way across the map of the empire at a stately 95 miles an hour. The journey might take days, but then the alternative by ship took weeks. The HP-42 set new standards in comfort and cuisine. Flying Imperial Airways in those days meant just that, with refuelling stops at romantic, isolated staging posts set in remote corners of that vast empire beyond the seas on which the sun had yet to set. Only eight of these aircraft were built, but their names became household words. And they flew literally millions of miles and carried hundreds of thousands of passengers right the way through until 1940. In 1935, the British government announced that it would carry all mail throughout the empire by air without a surcharge. So Imperial Airways, anticipating a huge increase in air freight, ordered straight from the drawing board a fleet of 28 Empire flying boats. That bold decision was totally justified. This is really one of the landmark aircraft of the British aviation industry. The design was far ahead of its day, with its superb all-metal stress-skin hull and metal-clad cantilevered wings. The engines were four Bristol Pegasus radials. The Empire flying boats flew all the Imperial Airways routes, eventually in 1937, crossing the Atlantic to New York. And when they were retired in 1947, the S-23s had flown no less than 38 million miles. The SPAC owes a great debt to the Royal Air Force, not least because the great pageants at Hendon in the 20s and 30s, put on to keep the beleaguered Air Force in the public eye, became in a very real sense the home of the annual exhibitions held by the SPAC. The first SPAC show was in 1932. Now, at that first SPAC show at Hendon, there were just 34 aircraft on display from no fewer than 13 different aircraft manufacturers, including Avro's and Armstrong Whitworth, Vickers and Westland. No public were allowed, nor any cameras either, strangely enough, apparently for the sake of security. There was also an equipment tent with just 16 manufacturers displaying their wares. There were two real stars of the show. One was the latest pride and joy from Handley Page, the Hayford Night Bomber, the last of the RAF's biplane bombers that stayed in service in less than 9 years, right the way through until 1941. At the other end of the scale, there was the tiny de Havilland Puss Moth. Now, throughout the 30s, several great flyers with immense courage and resource, like Amy Johnson and Jim Mollison and C.W. Scott, made a whole string of long-distance record-breaking flights all over the world in one or other of the de Havilland Moth family. And these small and relatively inexpensive aeroplanes contributed perhaps more than any other type to the huge spread of popular aviation in the 30s. They also transformed de Havilland from a small, hard-pressed aircraft manufacturer in a suburb of North London to a big public company with a big international network, including subsidiaries in Canada and Australia. So while the rest of the British aircraft industry was struggling to survive, de Havilland was struggling to keep pace with demand. Forebodingly, German aircraft makers were facing the same problem, because Hitler had come to power and begun to rearm. In the UK, the emergency expansion schemes went into operation, not a moment too soon. In 1935, to celebrate King George V's Silver Jubilee, the RAF held the biggest flypast in its history. It was almost the entire RAF, 356 aircraft representing the 25 regular and 12 auxiliary squadrons. The spectacle was put on with typical panache and precision, but the frontline aircraft the RAF had to display were desperately obsolescent. In a classic manner, the fighters were dominated by the design concepts of the war that had long since been won. Apart from the supercharged Kestrel engines from Rolls-Royce, the technology was that of the Great War. Steel-framed, fabric-covered biplanes with fixed undercarriages and open cockpits. These superbly trained RAF pilots in their elegant Hawker Furies delighted the crowds at Hendon year after year with their precision squadron aerobatics. But these were no longer aircraft that could win an air war. The bombers, lumbering biplanes like the Virginia and the Hayford, were no faster or more effective than the old Vimy. There was a strong wind of change blowing, generated by men like Hawker's chief designer, Sidney Cam.
As you know, we've been thinking around this problem for some time. And without any doubt, it means leaving the biplane, which we know so well, and going to the monoplane with heavier armament and many new features such as closed cockpit, retractable undercarriage, higher wing loading, and of course, new structural problems.
Hawker's brilliant new concept fighter was, of course, the Hurricane, which first flew in November 1935, built around that most magical of engines, the Merlin. This V12 liquid-cooled supercharged engine for the first time offered designers over 1,000 horsepower. The increase in power was largely due to the design of the supercharger, which owed a great deal to the experience gained during the challenge for the Schneider Trophy in the early 30s. But the Merlin's great attraction, apart from its power, was that it had an extremely small cross-sectional area, so that aircraft it powered could have narrow, streamlined fuselages. The Hurricane was one result, another was the Supermarine Type 300, the Spitfire, which first flew in 1936. The Spitfire was a revolution, with its stress-skin fuselage and its famous broad-chord elliptical wings. It owed a great deal to the earlier collaboration between R.J. Mitchell, the designer, and Sir Henry Royce on the Schneider Trophy planes, and it proved to be a fighter with almost unlimited scope for development. ...1936 was a year of no turning back. Hitler reoccupied the Rhineland and laid the groundwork for the annexation of Austria, the Anschluss. In England, Robert Watson Watt, a young scientist at the National Physical Laboratory, pressed ahead with his research that led eventually to the development of radar, a system able to detect the height, range and bearing of aircraft over 100 miles away. The mast that sprouted along Britain's southern and eastern coasts would soon play a vital role in a great air battle. But in 1938, they tracked the aircraft that carried Neville Chamberlain back from his bogus negotiations with Adolf Hitler.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine.
Despite charges of appeasement, that worthless piece of paper gave Britain a priceless year in which to make up for two decades of neglect. Even so, by September 1939, as the German Stukas took off to attack Poland and begin World War II, Fighter Command was still under strength. The screaming dive bombers proved to be the spearhead of a totally new form of mechanized war, Blitzkrieg or Lightning War, and lightning it proved to be. Armoured columns blasted their way across Europe. The Low Countries, Belgium, France all fell in a matter of weeks until the German armies reached the Channel coast. Britain seemed doomed, and Hermann Göring, the commander of the Luftwaffe, had boasted that his invincible air force could bomb Britain into submission within 2 weeks. Many observers in those dark days of 1940 considered that to be a reasonable proposition. History, however, has proved them to be mistaken. The story of the RAF's finest hour doesn't require retelling here. It suffices to say, it was the first decisive battle fought entirely in the air. In the course of the battle, the Germans lost 1,767 aircraft destroyed. The RAF lost 922 fighters and 419 pilots killed in action. But what the Battle of Britain demonstrated beyond doubt was that whereas in the First World War, aircraft had played a marginal role, in the Second, they would be central and decisive at every turn. Despite bombings and blackout, the entire aircraft industry worked round the clock, producing an ever-increasing flow of aircraft with a workforce that now included many thousands of young women, many of whom had never before even seen an aircraft close to. Not only fighters for defence, but bombers with which to strike back. Bombers by night, fighter sweeps by day. Until June 1944, the only way that war could be brought to the enemy in Europe was by air. Aircraft played just as vital a role in the Battle of the Atlantic. Germany's U-boats came very close to victory, but a combination of convoy tactics, radar, and aircraft patrols turned the tide. Indeed, the mere presence of an aircraft was sufficient to cause a U-boat to dive. Young crews of Bomber Command began to play a key role in the war effort right from the outset, with their attacks first on the mass troops of the German invasion forces in 1940, and then on the vital U-boat pens. But it was really the advent of the four-engine bomber, particularly the Avro Lancaster, perhaps the finest heavy bomber of the war, which could carry 14,000 pounds of bombs over 1,600 miles, that really opened up the possibility of a sustained bombing offensive against the German heartland. Night after night, crews took off to navigate their way for hundreds of miles across a blacked-out Europe towards their heavily defended targets. A Lancaster bomber flies in the Battle of Britain Memorial flight as the national symbol of their immense courage. On June the 6th, 1944, the biggest air armada the world has ever seen was assembled for the D-Day landings. And air power has never since lost its dominant role. Control of the air, in attack or defence, has remained the decisive military strategy. The jet engine really came too late to influence the course of the war, the Gloster Meteor's main task being to catch and knock down German flying bombs. But the gas turbine was the most revolutionary development in aviation history since the Wright brothers flew in 1903. Frank Whittle first had the idea as a cadet at Cranwell in 1928. But it was rejected by the Air Ministry as impractical. And throughout the 30s, Whittle found it almost impossible to get financial backing or government support. So it wasn't until May 1941 that the prototype Gloster E2839 was rolled out at Cranwell, a day that transformed the aviation world. With earlier government commitment, who knows, Britain might well have had the jet fighter at the beginning of the war rather than at the end.
At the end of the war, the aircraft industry emerged as the largest in the country. It employed nearly 2 million men and women, and there were many areas of technology where Britain undoubtedly led the world. There was a tremendous sense of being poised on the edge of a vast new frontier. And although rationing was to stay in force for another 7 or 8 years, and the economy ricocheted from crisis to crisis, the aircraft industry scored triumph after triumph.
In 1942, at the height of the war, a far-sighted government had set up a committee under the chairmanship of Lord Brabazon to organise government support for developing advanced post-war airliners. The Vickers Viscount, yet again another truly historic British aircraft, was the first real product of that committee's deliberations. It first flew in July 1948 with four Rolls-Royce Dart engines, not merely the world's first turboprop airliner, but representing a spectacular advance over contemporary piston engine transports. But the original design was too small for BEA's liking, and the project almost stalled. But a stretched 53-seater was developed, and the Viscount really never looked back. It went into full scheduled service with BEA 1953 and became one of Britain's most successful aircraft ever, with 459 sold around the world, many of them still flying to this day. At the 1950 SBAC show, the tiny experimental DH-108 Swallow grabbed the headlines by diving through the sound barrier. And Armstrong Whitworth stunned the crowds with the extraordinary AW-52 Flying Wing, incidentally one of the first British aircraft to be fitted with and use a Martin Baker ejection seat. A year later, Bristol Aircraft first flew what was perhaps the most sensational product of the Brabazon Committee and the only one to bear his name, the Brabazon. This immense dinosaur weighed 130 tonnes and had a wingspan of 230 feet. With its Bristol Centaurus engines, it was designed to carry passengers across the Atlantic. But it proved to be hopelessly uneconomic. The two prototypes languished at Filton until they were broken up. The total cost of the Brabazon project was over £11 million. But already there was a new shape and a new sound in the skies, which had far more commercial promise, the immensely beautiful form of the de Havilland Comet. It dazzled all who saw it, and the ghost-powered Comet, cruising at 400 knots and 40,000 feet, shattered records wherever it went. And when it came into service in May 1952, Britain ruled the commercial skies. And in September of that year, Comet 3 was announced, with a stretched fuselage to take up to 76 passengers and powered with 9,000-pound thrust Avons. This was the transatlantic Comet that was ordered by Pan American. Comet was at least 2 years ahead of any conceivable competition and seemed set to dominate the air routes of the world, but it was not to be. Crashes on takeoff in Rome and Karachi were followed in 1954 by two aircraft disintegrating in flight over the Mediterranean. The Comet fleet was grounded, and an investigation was started at Farnborough. A fuselage was immersed in a test tank to simulate changes in pressurization loads during climb and descent. The fuselage fractured after 1,800 cycles. The Court of Inquiry ruled that nobody was to blame. De Havilland and BOAC had simply pushed too far into the unknown. But for the British aviation industry, it was a profound disaster. The Comet was a powerful enough phoenix to rise from the ashes, and the Comet 4 went into transatlantic service in October 1958. But by then, Boeing and Douglas had produced brilliant, long-range jet airliners on the back of their huge military programs, and the long-haul market was lost in some ways for good.
As the Comet saga was unfolding, the Cold War was growing increasingly chilly, underlined by the fury of the Korean conflict that broke out in July 1950. It was the first jet-powered air war, and sadly Britain, that had given the jet engine to both the Russians and the Americans, didn't have a jet fighter that could compete with either the Sabres or the MiG-15s. So the early 50s called for yet another swing in policy, a big increase in defence spending, with a big slice of that going on the magnificent Canberra.
The Canberra was really an extraordinary success. Designed as a light bomber and built around the superb new Rolls-Royce axial flow gas turbine, the AJ-56 or Avon, it could carry 6,000 pounds of bombs over 1,600 miles at 50,000 feet and 550 miles an hour. None of the RAF's fighters could catch it. The Canberra went on to equip no fewer than 61 RAF squadrons in a huge range of roles. and it was the first British military aircraft since the DH-4 in 1918 to be adopted by the US Air Force. It still remains in service in many corners of the world. In the 1950s, Britain was V-bomber mad. A new strategy called for near-supersonic bombers, flying at very high altitudes, to carry nuclear weapons deep into enemy territory. And despite their colossal expense, the government of the day saw fit to test the concept with three radically different designs. The huge delta-wing configuration of the Vulcan, for example, was wholly unconventional. But the Valiant was in fact the first of the V-bombers to go into squadron service. Boldly swept wings and four 10,000-pound thrust Avons, it was a revelation. It was, remember, replacing the aging, lumbering piston-engine Lincolns. It could penetrate enemy airspace at over 560 miles an hour at over 50,000 feet. It also, incidentally, introduced in-flight refueling as a key element in Bomber Command's strategy. The Handley Page Victor was the third of the V-bomber trio, with its distinctive crescent-shaped wings, with decreasing sweep back from wing root to wing tip. During the Victor's lifetime, the strategy changed from high-level penetration to low-level, but the aircraft was susceptible to low-level fatigue stress. It actually ended its life as a tanker. What Fighter Command was looking for was a new fighter to replace the aging Meteors. The Supermarine Swift came from the same stable as the illustrious Spitfire. But although it established a new world speed record of 738 miles an hour in 1953, it eventually only equipped one interceptor squadron, number 56 at Waterbeach, where it was said it spent a lot of time in the hangars with the access panels off. It was the Hunter from the same stable as the Hurricane that turned out to be one of the most successful of all British jet fighter designs. And in the hands of the redoubtable Treble One Squadron Black Arrows, here seen going through their paces over Farnborough, it electrified airshow crowds all over the world. By 1958, all RAF day fighter squadrons were flying Hunter F-6s, powered by the immensely reliable Avon. It had a top speed of over 715 miles an hour. And there's no doubt about this aircraft's ruggedness. Many Hunters have seen service with several air forces and are still flying. In March 1956, piloted by Peter Twiss, the needle-nosed Fairey Delta II raised the world speed record to 1,132 miles an hour, not only introducing the era of 1,000 miles an hour flight, but giving Great Britain, albeit for just 2 years, all three speed records on land, in sea, and in the air. The runway's all yours. The FD-2 went on to explore the performance of Delta wings at supersonic speeds and thus make a major contribution to the development of Concorde. But while Peter Twiss was extending the envelope, so to speak, over southern Britain, British troops were involved in fighting the Malayan War, a war in which helicopters began to come into their own. Westland began to move into helicopters as their main line of business. They steadily acquired the helicopter interests of other manufacturers in the UK and forged stronger links with the giant Sikorsky in the USA. The Wessex was built to an existing Sikorsky design, the S-58, with a piston engine removed and replaced by gas turbines. The result was a stunning improvement in performance. The Westland went hissing by at 130 miles an hour. It was an immense success with both the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy, and served all over the world in a tremendous variety of roles.
The mid-1950s proved to be something of a post-war high for the British aviation industry. It had become virtually the jewel in the British industrial crown. A whole series of radical new aircraft types had been successfully introduced. British gas turbines remained among the finest in the world, and the equipment and components sector had grown almost beyond recognition to rival in scale and value the higher profile airframe and engine sectors. In 1956, for the very first time, the industry achieved over £100 million worth of exports. And then in 1957, two revolutions took place. The Russians launched a tiny, grapefruit-sized satellite into orbit, and the Sputnik, bleeping its way around the Earth, introduced the space age. And Duncan Sands launched his famous or infamous defense white paper, described by the president of the SPAC as a most calamitous document.
Essentially, the new strategy waved farewell to the man-fighter and eventually the man-bomber as well. The future would be dominated by missiles. It was argued that in the face of a potential enemy as large as the USSR, conventional fighter protection, as in the Battle of Britain, for example, was impossible. Defence lay in deterrence. Initially, this meant providing a credible defence for Britain's only deterrent force, the nuclear-armed V-bomber bases. And the most effective defence, it was argued, was provided by surface-to-air missiles rather than manned fighters. The first of these missiles to go into service was the Bristol Bloodhound. The first squadron became operational in 1958. By 1960, there were 12, so high was the priority. The missile had a proximity-fused warhead and a speed in excess of Mach 2. It homed in on the target via a radar guidance system. And it had a considerable range, obtained from two liquid-fueled ramjets that took over after the solid-fueled rocket launchers had dropped away. By 1964, the Mark II Bloodhound had been produced, which could take out low-level targets. But by then it was clear that the strategy was gravely flawed. The SAM missile was not only a hugely expensive weapon, it was, it had been learned, a strictly limited one. The English Electric Lightning just scraped it under the wire. In the 60s, it went into service, releasing the obsolescent Hunters for the ground attack role to which they were better suited. The Lightning's great strength was its performance. The two superimposed Avons gave it superb acceleration to Mach 2, and it could reach 60,000 feet in under 5 minutes. Its weaknesses were its endurance. It ended up with a more or less permanent ventral tank. It was always known in NATO as a fuel-critical aircraft. And its somewhat limited armament, just the 30mm cannon and two heat-seeking fire streak or red-top missiles. But over 300 were built, and it remained a frontline fighter, a key link in the chain of defence against the might of the Russian bomber fleets for over 30 years. Meanwhile, the high-tech TSR-2 was promised as all things to all airmen. But TSR-2, along with Blue Steel and several other potential air defence systems, was scrapped in an orgy of political pragmatism.
The TSR-2 in its day was well in advance of almost anything else in the world in military aircraft design, development and production. It had long range, it had high speed, it had high bomb capacity, it had good reconnaissance capacity. It was a splendid aircraft design. It was probably the finest aircraft design produced by the British in the post-war period up to that time. Unfortunately, it was expensive. And in the political and economic climate of the mid-1960s, the government of the day decided it was too expensive and cancelled it. Now, that was ultimately to be seen to be a mistaken decision, because subsequently we have spent far more in developing the kind of aeroplanes that TSR-2 could have evolved into than we would have ever spent if we had just gone on with TSR-2.
The late 50s isn't a favourite period in the memory of the British aviation industry. It was really shotgun marriage time, with various amounts of pushing and shoving from government ministers. We ended up with just two major airframe manufacturers, Hawker Siddeley and British Aircraft Corporation. So not surprisingly, when old friends met at the Farnborough shows, the talk was of mergers and amalgamations. Not just for the airframe makers. Only two major engine makers emerged. Rolls-Royce, with its huge international reputation in both the civil and military fields, and its pioneering leadership in the manufacture and design of jet engines. And Bristol Siddeley engines at Filton.
In 1964, the Farnborough Show became a biannual event was also the year in which the Society changed its name to the Society of British Aerospace Companies, obviously to mark the huge increase in aerospace activities. 2 years later was the 50th anniversary of the Society. Despite a decade of great upheaval, it was really in great shape. It had over 500 members, it had achieved exports of well over £200 million. At a time when the government had a finger in almost every pie, it was alive with successful private ventures.
Not least among them was the BAC-111, which started out in life as an idea at hunting aircraft. When they were absorbed into BAC in 1958, it was developed into an 80-seat replacement for the Viscount. It went into service in 1964 and was a resounding success, eventually selling into the tough US market as well as behind the Iron Curtain. But undoubtedly one of the greatest moments in the 60s, indeed in British aviation history, was when test pilot Bill Bedford climbed into the unique Hawker P-1127 to achieve the first vertical takeoff, hover and landing in a jet aircraft. The concept of VSTOL had been established. By 1969, the first Harriers were being delivered to No. 1 Squadron to make them the first operational VSTOL squadron in the world, powered by the 21,000-pound thrust Bristol Pegasus engine and equipped with a state-of-the-art Ferranti-Nav attack system. It was also the first RAF aircraft to have the Smith HUD, or head-up display system. But of course, the great operational significance of the Harrier is its vertical and short takeoff capability that frees it from the tyranny of established airfields. It is infinitely flexible in operation, as it proved of such powerful effect during the Falklands War and in service with the US Marines. Indeed, British Aerospace and McDonnell Douglas have jointly developed the Aviate-B, or GR-5, for the US Marines and the RAF, with a massive use of carbon fibre structures and improved wing design to give the aircraft higher performance and greater weapons-carrying capability. It seems set to remain the only effective VSTOL fighter in the Western world until well into the next century. It certainly stands out as a remarkable British achievement. On the 2nd of March 1969, 001, the French prototype Concorde, made its first flight out of Toulouse with André Turcat at the controls. The British-built airframe 002 flew a week or so later, piloted by Brian Trubshaw. Concorde achieved Mach 1 on its first flight, and by the end of March, it had exceeded Mach 2.3.
Since that time, literally millions of words have been written about this superb aeroplane, so let me confine myself to just a few of the facts, because there can be no question about the sheer scale of the technical achievement. The dozen Concordes in service have flown well over 100 million miles in perfect safety. They've logged up over 75,000 hours at supersonic speeds, over 60,000 of those in excess of Mach 2. That's probably more hours at Mach 2 than all the world's military aircraft put together. Truly a remarkable achievement. But as to whether supersonic transport is a viable element in this supremely competitive field of civil aviation, well, of course, the jury is still out. Concorde was posited on the philosophy of the sheer dominance of speed. Any airline, it was argued, that could just about halve the flying time between major centres would draw in a never-ending stream of passengers willing to pay a very high premium indeed for the pleasure of getting there that much faster. And to an extent, that has happened. What has muddied the economic water, so to speak, has been the growing resistance to noise pollution, which has severely restricted the number of routes on which Concorde's speed advantage could be maximised. And then there's the sheer cost of operating, let alone building, SASTs. Concorde, remember, was laid down back in the 60s, a time of great optimism when industry was, to an extent, engineer-led. It'll be another quarter century, perhaps, before its successor appears, if at all. Now, that's a huge gap of time in aviation terms, equivalent to that between, say, the Sopwith Camel and Concorde itself. It's a long, long way to be ahead of the field.
So, will there ever be a son of Concorde?
I think there almost certainly will be a son of Concorde, a Concorde Mark II. It's going to be a 350-seater. It's going to have a much longer range than the current Concorde, trans-Pacific rather than transatlantic. There are groups working on it now. If they go ahead strongly, it could be ready in another 10 years.
Two other events occurred in 1969 that marked perhaps the greatest turning point in the post-war history of the British aerospace industry. Britain, Germany and Italy agreed to design and build a new multi-role combat aircraft. Within 6 years, the prototypes were flying. And the Tornado's superb performance During the Gulf War, carrying out perhaps the most testing mission of them all, has amply demonstrated the toughness and capabilities of this fine aircraft. In the same year, West Germany and France signed an agreement to produce an all-European civil airliner. The British government dithered first one way, then the other, and finally withdrew from this crucial project. Fortunately for the industry, Hawker Siddeley had the wit and the foresight to join the consortium privately and build the wings. But these two ventures really set the seal on the development of the industry for the remainder of the century. Collaboration and amalgamation are very much the name of the modern game.
And of course, if you look back over the history of the British commercial aviation industry, the reason it hasn't been as strong as military is that we didn't have a captive home market. We tried to go it alone with exciting programs from, the first of everything, the first jet aircraft, the first trijet aircraft, the first turboprop aircraft to cross the Atlantic, the first supersonic passengers were aircraft with the French. We've not been bad at doing firsts. What we've not been good at is converting those firsts into a real commercial success, and therefore the volume was never there in our programmes. Now, of course, turning to international partnerships and to collaboration, if you like, for the first time in a meaningful way in Airbus, you can see how the greater substance develops in a programme where there is a wider home market, more of the same proportions that the Americans have benefited from, and of course the ability to fund aircraft of an outreaching kind in technology terms that the market requires.
Rolls-Royce discovered the immense risk of going it alone in building the RB211 engine for the Lockheed TriStar. Problems in the development programme forced this huge and talented company into receivership in 1971.
Well, there are a lot of lessons which we learned from the RB211, from that episode. The most important one is that you have to develop the technology well ahead of taking that technology to market in a product. Today, we run demonstrator programs, technology programs, advanced engineering programs 6 to 10 years ahead of requiring that technology in the marketplace. The result of that is modern engines go into service very quickly based on technology which we have a great deal of faith in before we commit to an actual engine program. I think my own personal view is at that time neither the city nor the government were well enough organized to understand how these things can be handled. There have been lots of examples since. I don't believe the company need have gone into receivership. Once that had happened, of course, the government then had to make some decision about protecting the 100 air forces around the world to whom we are major suppliers, and of course most of all the RAF and the Royal Navy. So there was little left for them to do but to secure the aviation business, the aero engine business.
But the problems faced by Rolls-Royce were small compared to the immense repercussions of the Yom Kippur War in 1973. It brought to an end a century of cheap fuel and energy and transformed the economics of commercial aviation. Within weeks, Pan American and TWA cancelled their orders for 13 Concords.
The strike will start on the 10th of February.
In Britain, the chaos was confounded by a national miners' strike that toppled the Heath government in a matter of months, and in doing so, laid the foundations of the bitterness that characterised government-union relations throughout the 80s. 1975 was a watershed year for the record. Concorde made the first quadruple crossing of the Atlantic in a day, out and back twice in 24 hours. Not bad. But the big event had to be the introduction of the nationalisation bill for the aviation industry. And 2 years later, in April 1977, British Aircraft Corporation and Hawker Siddeley were merged to form mighty British Aerospace. All the old names, BAC, Hawker Siddeley Aviation and Dynamics and Scottish Aviation, disappear from the notepaper, although not, of course, from the record books. But it meant that the 10-year process of reorganisation and restructuring had finally run its course. By then, the aerospace industry had been through almost 20 years of what has to be called high-level turbulence, years of indecision and cancellation, with rapid changes of government leading to radical swings in policy, years above all of financial stringency. In the late 70s, for example, the inflation rate was well over 20%. But despite this largely hostile environment, the aerospace industry had become immensely powerful. It employed some
215,000 people, as many as the rest of Europe's aviation industries combined, had a turnover of more than £2.5 billion, with exports in excess of £1 billion. So it represented a huge repository of skills and knowledge and expertise, an immense national resource.
But it's an industry that will need all its skill and resource to meet the whole new set of problems in the 90s and beyond, as the walls of Eastern Europe come tumbling down.
I think that now it's time to break the wall down, you know.
As the old enemies fade away, how should the industry face up to the new challenge?
Whilst the defence, an immediate need for defence might go away, it hasn't gone for all time. And unless you keep the technologies alive, unless you keep the R&D base there, then you will not be in a position to respond eventually when times change. So I think whether you are producing hardware in large amounts or not at a certain time, the nation needs to keep a technology bank, a bank of R&D. Otherwise, you're just surrendering the possibilities of any kind of independence of defence policy. Or even if you have a defence policy, you can't carry it out independently because you will not have the resources to do so. So R&D is especially important, and it's especially important that the British government should have a policy in respect of R&D, even if they don't quite have one in respect of defence posturing at the moment.
Everybody in the industry faces the fact that technology is becoming more and more and more complex, and that means more and more and more expensive. That in turn means that anything that the industry does is going to cost a lot more money. And that in turn means that no one company, no one country can develop any really new aeroplane by itself. We have the classic example today with the European fighter aircraft. Here in Western Europe with the British, the West Germans and the Italians all at work on this particular aeroplane. So yes, the answer I think, when one looks at the future of the industry, it has to be one of increased collaboration, and not just on a regional basis within Western Europe, but globally.
But the British industry has, throughout its equipment companies, engine companies, as well as through British Aerospace, a major airframe company, had many very important and continuing programmes with the United States. And of course, there's an alliance across the Atlantic, which is fundamentally important and not to be ignored. And so I think Britain's job is that, continuing to be that island off Europe, has got to continue to have an intermediary role. I think we cannot commit ourselves wholly one way or the other. And I think European companies too will, as soon as the sort of priority is over to huddle together in the community, will look to transatlantic or even trans-Pacific relationships.
I can foresee what's going to happen during the next decade. But it's the decade after that that we now have to start paying attention to, because that's going to lead into totally different technologies. Materials technology, for instance, is moving at a very fast pace. We aren't going to see ceramic engines and ceramic metal composite engines in the next 5 years, but we are going to see them in the next 10 to 15 years, and they will have a profound effect on what happens not only to the gas turbine for aviation purposes, but maybe to extend the whole market for gas turbines, maybe even through into the automotive field.
As I look forward the next 10 or 15 years for our industry, I have a degree of optimism, perhaps tempered with a little realism, based upon the last 75 years of ups and downs of our industry. But it's such an important industry, which is at the forefront of so many technologies. It's the sort of industry that every advanced nation in the world wants and is willing to invest in. And with our competitiveness on all fronts, aircraft, engines, systems, missiles, helicopters, Britain's got it. It's the most integrated industry in the world after the United States. With all these advantages, I must look forward with a degree of optimism. And it's our job to make sure in the next 10 to 15 years, we leave behind an industry for our successors as successful as the one today.